Hello, and welcome back to Hanging Out with the Dream King, a Neil Gaiman podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brent Helt. This episode, Forbidden Brides of the Faceless Slaves in the Secret House of the Knight of Dread Desire, originally published in 2004's Gothic.
Yeah, originally published in this this anthology, Gothic, in 2004, but per the introduction, and this is something that you brought to the table when we encountered this story in The Sandman, or this phrase anyway, in The Sandman, this is a much older story than that. This was a trunk story that Gaiman had, lying around. That's what a trunk story is, though revised at that point, and maybe that's something we'll talk about at the end. And I say introduction, and I mean the introduction to the collection Fragile Things, which is where we read this. Before we get into the story, though, we do want to take a minute here to let you know about a new goal that we have on Patreon. We took a poll among our current Patreon supporters to decide which major Lovecraft work Brandon, who's my co-host on Eldersign, which major Lovecraft work Brandon and I should cover on an extended Patreon-exclusive series. And this was in part motivated by the fact that the three of us, Brent, Brandon, and I, have visited Lovecraft's fictional town of Innsmouth for this podcast when we've done Gaiman's story, Only the End of the World Again. And I'm using the past tense because we've already recorded it, even though we haven't aired it yet. That's actually going to be the episode that comes out after this one. But then right after we recorded that, Brandon and I did two episodes on Eldersign about Caitlin R. Kiernan's Innsmouth-related story, Houses Under the Sea. And so we thought, maybe we should do The Shadow over Innsmouth at some point. But it turns out we're not going to. Or at least we're not doing it right away, because the Patreon supporters have spoken, and what they want us to do is At the Mountains of Madness. So we'll do that over the course of several episodes. That's going to be our next Patreon goal. So at the time of recording this, we're really only a few new supporters away from hitting that goal. And actually, what that means is that by the time you're listening to this, we've probably reached that goal. So really, what we're saying is, if you're interested in hearing those episodes, if that is something that would compel you to buy the four of us a cup of coffee to share each month, it is probably already up on Patreon. So you can join us and get access to that bonus series right away. It's certainly something I'm really excited to get to do. So I hope we get to.
I'm really looking forward to hearing you and Brandon talk about At the Mountains of Madness, so I really hope that we hit that goal, because while not my favorite Lovecraft story, it's definitely up there, and there's definitely, I think, a lot of stuff that can be dug into there, and a lot of rich veins to mine, if you will.
Yeah, At the Mountains of Madness is a novel. It's really one of the two, maybe two and a half novels that Lovecraft wrote. The half there is the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, which just has all sorts of caveats attached to it, though that's one I'd be really excited to do. But At the Mountains of Madness tends to be fairly polarizing among Lovecraft fans. So I was actually surprised that it won. I think there are people who really love it, and there are people who find it to be the most boring thing that there's ever been. But I'm in the love it camp, so I'm going to be really excited to talk about it. I have not read At the Mountains of Madness since I've gone to grad school, since before I've gone to grad school. And so now that I have gone to grad school for being an academic, I will be excited to read the Antarctic adventures of a bunch of nerds, you know, a bunch of nerdy academics. I think that will be a lot of fun. Also a lot of fun, though, is this story that we're here to talk about today. And we decided to do this story because the title of it appeared in the issue Into the Night that we did a few months ago. And we talked for a long time, actually, about that phrase. And you had done your homework at the time, Brent, but I just didn't remember this story, even though I have had Fragile Things since the moment it came out and know that I've read it cover to cover. So I was really excited to revisit this one. And I'm glad that we did. I really enjoyed this story.
And I enjoyed it more the second time. The first time I read it, I was not really in the mood for it. But I think it's best to talk about that after we walk through the story itself. But I enjoyed it a lot more the second time that I've read it recently. I don't remember what I thought of it when I first read it back when Fragile Things came out. I must have read it, you know, a decade ago or more. But I don't really recall that. But I remember picking it up and reading it hurriedly in preparation for our Into the Night commentary, and I was not enjoying it as much. I think I was more by the end, but this time I reread it for preparation for this podcast, and I enjoyed it a lot more throughout.
Well, I think mood is the word to emphasize there, because this is a moody piece. And, you know, any piece that is moody, any piece that is about the mood and the atmosphere, if you're not there, if you're not in that mood or can't get in that mood, like if you're not adjacent enough to that mood to be drawn there by the story, then it's not going to work. And maybe we should start by talking about even just the structure of this story. It was like Gaiman has very nicely divided this story into numbered sections. There's 9 of them. This is something that I always appreciate because it makes podcast discussions a lot easier, because we could just recap each section and then talk about each section and then do the next one. That is a lot of fun. That makes it very easy for us to do our jobs. But there is more going on with the structure here than just that, because Gaiman is also playing with the font. Some of the sections are in a regular font. I mean, whatever the font of Fragile Things is. Actually, I couldn't find that on the copyright page, but I was interested because I think it looks very nice. But then some of the sections are in bold. We'll talk about why and what's going on with that. We'll do that in just a moment. But I just want to say at the top here that I really liked this as a visual device. I especially liked the decision to use bold instead of italics, because I hate italics. And the first section here is in the regular font, but then underneath the Roman numeral 1 is just one sentence. Somewhere in the night, someone was writing. And then we just go straight to Roman numeral 2, which is several pages in this bold font. So even without getting into the content of section 2, we just immediately infer that the bold text is going to be whatever this someone, somewhere in the night, is writing. This is really great visual storytelling in what is a prose piece, right? This is Gaiman using visual media here. It's something that doesn't necessarily require it. It really worked for me.
I really enjoyed it too. And I don't know if it was Gaiman's idea or the editor or, you know, typesetter or whoever, but yes, it's excellent. And I'm glad that they did not use italics as well. I think oftentimes when we do want to convey that something is the thing that is being written, italics look a little bit more like script. And so people oftentimes default to thinking that that's the way to go. But particularly when there's a lot of dense text, it's just harder to read. And I think you may layer a tone on that in a way that you don't want to layer. Although I think with bold you do as well. And I think actually having a bold, direct, kind of powerful looking text suits the story elements that are going on in the even Roman numerals. And I think, Glenn, for simplicity's sake, because we're talking about a short story, and so we might use the word story a lot, let's refer to them as story A and story B. Story A being the normal typeset that is the odd Roman numerals, and story B being the even Roman numerals. And that way, if we mention the story, then hopefully we'll be clear as to which story if we mean the meta story versus, you know, which character.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic idea. So let's get into the bold type story, right, which is story B. And then this is section 2. And this is where the mood comes in, right? This is a thick, moody, gothic piece. It begins in the middle of the night. There's a young woman. She's running as if the legions of hell are after her. There's a house ahead with a single light burning on the topmost floor. And when she gets there, she pounds on the door, and it seems to take forever for someone to answer. And the man who does answer the door doesn't actually open it, but in fact, what he does is question her from his side of the door. And his voice sounds like crackling parchment and musty grave hangings. That is a simile that I just adore. But the deal is this. She is Amelia Earnshaw, and she's come to this part of England to take up a position as the governess to the children of Lord Falconmere. Moreover, she is the orphan daughter of the Honorable Hubert Earnshaw, who drowned trying to save her mother in a tragic boating accident. And this fact means that this house is hers. It's her inheritance, though apparently she never knew anything about that, and this is just a crazy coincidence that starts off this story. And so the old man lets her in, and he looks like a jack-o'-lantern or a particularly elderly axe murderer. Just another brilliant phrase there. And he leads her down a long corridor to a door to the basement, which he unlocks with a massive jangly keychain, and then ominously says, "There are some as are what they are, and there are some as aren't what they seem to be, and there are some as only seem to be what they seem to be." Whatever that means, right? And they begin to head downstairs, where it smells of must and dust and abandonment. But then this section of story B ends here. So we're going to have to wait to find out what is in the basement. But I think we do need here, Brent, to talk about, right, the tone, the mood of this bold font story here, of story B.
Yeah, I think we do. But I just want to add where you stopped reading there. I like that it continues, "Mark my words and mark them well, Hubert Earnshaw's daughter. Do you understand me?" And at this point, I don't understand him. I don't know why she would understand him. I don't know why anyone would understand him. It seems like nonsense. But yes, I mean, it's all over the top, kind of melodramatic prose in a very... it's a lot of tropes of kind of Gothic literature going on here, right? And a lot of that era of weird fiction. It's almost more atmosphere than it even is plot. You know, we have bits in which she, you know, the coachman shoos her away, but we're getting more out of even chewing up all of the scenery, so much so that we're tasting it. And I like the fact that throughout there are many ways in which people are described to be like scenery, and scenery is described in a way, or, you know, things within the scene as if they're alive. And I think that that's just because the whole thing is just kind of a very deliberately placed, you know, set of, you know, stage props in some way. But it works. It works for me to think that velvet has a noise, and it, which we come to later. And the voice sounding like crackling parchment. I mean, that's just you and I and the listener likely immediately know what that might sound like, even though that parchment doesn't crackle unto itself. There needs to be some kind of action performed on it for that to be occurring, right? Or it needs to be in a fire or something. So it's great. But it's over the top. But admittedly, the first time I read this, I just thought it was really bad writing, which I think it's kind of maybe supposed to be.
Yeah, I think that is the idea. And I think we should talk about whether or not it is bad writing, but we'll get a little bit more under our belt before we have that conversation. But yeah, you've hit the nail on the head here, Brent, right? This is, I mean, it's a pastiche. We should probably say that up front, right? What Gaiman is doing is writing a Gothic tale in the tradition of 19th century Gothic writing. This is Edward Bulwer Lytton is all over this. He's the, I don't know if he's famous anymore, but infamous. It was A Dark and Stormy Night, which is, you know, an iconic opening sentence, but is held up as being an example of poor writing, of the sort of purple prose that this genre was known for, and especially the sort of mediocre versions of this genre. Here we don't get "It was a dark and stormy night," but we do get repeatedly the phrase "this night of all nights." And, you know, we do have the character Amelia here pointing that out, saying, "Why do you keep saying that phrase? You've said it three times. What do you mean by it?" Which is also a great nod to The Hobbit. This is something Gandalf actually says to Bilbo about his frequent use of the phrase "good morning" to mean several different things. And, you know, Gaiman has nailed it. That's the thing, right? Is that he is doing a great job of mimicking this voice. And so I found it to be really fun, but he's also got the plot too. And in fact, I actually want to read another passage here. This is when Amelia announces who she is. I'll just read this. "'Tis I, Amelia Earnshaw, recently orphaned and now on my way to take up a position as a governess to the two small children, a boy and a girl, of Lord Falconmere, whose cruel glances I found during our interview in his London residence, both repellent and fascinating, but whose aquiline face haunts my dreams." And yeah, this is not great writing. It's not great storytelling, for sure, to put all this backstory in, like, this character monologue, like it's a stage play, and, you know, that the audience can only know things that characters are saying. But also, this setup is straight out of Jane Eyre or Vanity Fair. It's actually kind of a hodgepodge of the two of them, where this idea of a young, well-educated woman going to take up a job as a governess, and of course is going to become romantically involved with the father of these kids, who's got to be a widower, or is he really a widower, right? There's some mystery around where is the wife, what happened to the wife, and is the place haunted, and so on. And Gaiman is just nailing it. It's amazing.
I also like that intentionally when he's writing, he's throwing in $10 words where a 50-cent word, you know, word would do. And so it's just, it's great to see. It's a writer who is very consciously trying to write something that will grab you and that's gripping. And it kind of strains from that. in terms of not Neil Gaiman writing, but in terms of the writer in story A writing the story in story B.
Well, should we get back to the A story now?
Yeah, so then back to the A story, young man slams down his quill upon the manuscript and spatters ink across the ream of paper. And then there's a humorous little bit with as the rest proceeds and he ends up talking with his butler. The ink continues to get increasingly on his face and clothes, which I love the image of that. It's slapstick. A lot of this is just, it's great slapstick. I'm imagining that Groucho Marx is portraying this role at this point, in which he's complained to his butler, though, whose name I'm pronouncing as Toombs.
Oh, yeah. His name is definitely Toombs. Yeah. He has to be named Toombs. I mean, he could be called Gravestone, but Toombs.
And he explains to Toombs that he's unhappy because humor creeps in. Self-parody whispers at the edges of things. I find myself guying literary convention and sending up both myself and the whole scrivening profession. And he explains he's trying to tell a real story about, as he puts it, I'm trying to create a slice of life here, an accurate representation of the world as it is and of the human condition. Instead, I find myself indulging as I write in schoolboy parody of the foibles of my fellows. I make little jokes. He had smeared ink all over his face, very little, which is funny because it's just, it's humor upon humor, because we are seeing him, you know, from the third person perspective of having the ink on his face, in which that's funny. It's only kind of funny, but also then the layer of making fun of that. But it's also just him saying, you know, that he's, this is reality. His story B that he is trying to convey with this over the top gothic pastiche is what he thinks reality is and what he and his fellow schoolboys have normally experienced as they go through life when they have butlers named Toombs.
Right. And we're going to get more on this eventually, right? Gaiman is working a joke here, but at this point in the story, that's what it seems. It seems like, yep, the A story is our world. And this guy, for some reason, thinks that the stories that you would read in Penny Dreadful are what the world is really like. And so that seems to be what the joke is. But Gaiman is going to flip that on its head for us before too long.
So in addition to the butler Toombs, we also hear a cry from elsewhere in the house, in which it's revealed that Aunt Agatha is somewhere locked up and needs to be fed. Also, there behind the writer is a portrait that has its eyes cut out, and something with gold eyes is staring out at him, but he doesn't see it. And it's just all these great little throwaway details of what is going on around him, which, again, if he's trying to capture in the story B, what is the actual slice of life, he is kind of capturing it very well, maybe layering in some extra little jokes, but maybe not, because in many ways I actually found what's going on in story A to be funnier than what's going on in story B.
Yes, well, it is written with a funny tone, and this is, I think, one of the masterpiece things that Gaiman does here. It's a thing that I could only ever dream about being able to do as a writer, is to take seriously the joke and then jokeify the serious bit, and to write two stories that actually have a lot of the same DNA, but write them with totally different moods, or totally different tones anyway, if not totally different moods. I think that works brilliantly. This whole business with Aunt Agatha letting out an eerie cry from upstairs in the forbidden room, this is straight out of Jane Eyre, right? This is the woman locked in a forbidden room. I don't know about the eyes being cut out of the portrait. We've all seen this in Scooby-Doo, but I don't know that I've encountered this really anywhere other than Scooby-Doo or a pastiche of Scooby-Doo. I wasn't sure if that was from some 19th century novel that I just don't know or don't remember that bit. Are you aware of anything where that really happens, Brent?
I'm not. I'm only used to seeing it in, yeah, Scooby-Doo or Murder, She Wrote.
Oh, okay.
You know, classic television is really where I'm used to seeing that. Or, you know, maybe some old, like black and white monster movies. I feel like I might've seen the image of the whole eyes following you from the painting kind of thing, which is, it's always the ominous foreshadowing and to cue in the audience that there is something, you know, staring at you from behind the walls. The fact that the eyes are gold, is interesting to me, just because, or they're glinted a tawny gold rather, they may not be gold themselves, but, I don't know if that implies they're like cat's eyes or something supernatural here, or, you know, even some kind of Lovecraftian horror, or if it's just the way that the you know, flame from a candle is catching them, or the fire that's that the chambermaid has just kind of stoked further.
Yeah, I think we're definitely meant to infer that it is something that is not quite human, or at least not quite human anymore. There is one other allusion that Gaiman is making here. This business with the writer attempting to write this realism, but the jokes keep coming in. This is a nod to an occult detective story by Algernon Blackwood. This is a story in which John Silence, who's a precursor to John Constantine we've met, is called in to help a writer of lighthearted, humorous novels, but he suddenly can only write bitter and even horrific stories because his house is haunted. There's a ghost in the house. And so John Silence has been called in to fix this problem for him. This is a story that Brandon and I have covered over on Eldersign. It is called A Psychical Invasion. It's a story that both of us really loved. I think I loved it more than Brandon did, but I really, really loved it. And there's some dense 19th century prose there too, although I think it's technically really the first decade of the 20th century, but some dense Edwardian, if not Victorian, prose in that story. I think Blackwood is a beautiful writer, but he has been accused of being both loquacious and purple from time to time as well. And Gaiman has kind of nailed that idea here, which I quite enjoyed.
So going back to story B, as he resumes his writing, the servant is escorting Amelia with his black towel candle, and there's discussion about a lock that's been locked since her ancestor's time, and also that there is some master that the servant are the slaves to. And there's a lot of kind of confusion. I feel like there's a bit of expositionary dialogue that has been cut out in while we were away at story A and story B. He's just decided to either skip over that, or it's not important, or maybe he'll fill in the details later, in the way that sometimes when you're writing something, it's just like, no, let me get down some of the set pieces and then I'll backfill when I need to. Which is, I think, harder to do probably with a quill than it is with a modern computer. But
yeah, I don't know how people actually wrote stories without computers. But you know, some real masterpieces were written before the 1960s, so it is possible. But yeah, I think we've jumped ahead a little bit. My sense of this was definitely that we were coming in at the end of the mysterious old man's explanation to Amelia about what is going on around here. And as you say, even though we don't get the explanation, I think we get some clues so we can piece it together a little bit. There is this undead creature, some kind of undead creature anyway, that lives in the burial ground and has lived in the burial ground for a long time. It's the master here. Everyone else is its slave. Though I like, he adds this detail that they try to pretend otherwise, but at some regular interval that is unknown to us, this creature, whatever it is, has a demand, and that demand must be met. And even though efforts have been made to keep the creature away, it doesn't matter because there are tunnels that link the old crypt with the burial ground. And so there's just nothing to be done, which is just an awesome setup. And Amelia asks what she should do about this. She's kind of forgotten this whole, like, going to be the governess to Lord Falconmere thing, and is just like now the owner of this house. But the old man just tells her to run away while she can. And there's a gag here where he's in the middle of saying something and then trails off with, ah, it's her immortal, ah. And right, the deal is that he's been killed in the middle of his speech. And this is a gag just straight out of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, right? And it turns out that, you know, what's killed him is a crossbow bolt to the back of the head. This was fired by a dude who claims that the old man was already dead a long time ago, in fact. And when Amelia, I don't know, let's say investigates his body, she sees that, yep, this is true, and estimates that he's been dead for 100 years. And Gaiman cuts this scene off here. I mean, just sort of leaves us wondering who this crossbow wielding man is and why dead men are serving as butlers tonight. And you know, I know Gaiman is poking fun at these tropes and the heavy-handed narration, which I think you have not enjoyed maybe that much, Brent, but I love this story. At this point here, I love story B. I actually wish that we had this as a complete novel, not like a 500 page novel, but like a 200 page novel. I would read this for 200 pages and enjoy every freaking paragraph of it. But I don't know that that's how you're feeling at this point in the story.
I actually, by this point, I think I was Both times I read it, I think I started liking it a little bit more at this point. The first time, because I, you know, of recent times I've read it, the first of the more recent times I read it, I had a better sense as to the rhythm of things. Also, I had a better sense as to kind of who the major players are, that, you know, Amelia is going to be encountering people and the encounters may be relevant, but maybe not. But I don't need to be attached to anyone in the story other than her. And then in story A, then it's just what's going on with the scrivener, with the writer. And I think immediately anytime someone mentions the detail that a crossbow quarrel is also silver, a silver crossbow quarrel, immediately my Dungeons & Dragons playing self is just like, okay, so that would be effective against these monsters. So that helps it along. I also did really like the joke about your mortal ah. And what's interesting about the ah is, first of all, that her immediate response is, my what? Which, as you said, I mean, it's a very Monty Python joke. But additionally, there's not an exclamation point in your immortal awe. So it's just like he gets shot and then he just kind of stops, but he exclaims, but he doesn't actually exclaim. He just says, my immortal awe, as opposed to like how I feel I would react if I felt like I was just shot. Although he was shot in the back of the head. So who knows? But yes, and then he becomes just a pile of ooze. And so I think at this point I was a lot more in tune with what the story wanted the first time. So I was starting to relax a little bit and kind of, I think, more roll with it rather than try to make sense of any of it. I think initially when, as I was reading it, I was trying to make sense of it, and that's a mistake. Instead, it's like a roller coaster going through a weird collage of different parts of an amusement park where it's just like, wait, why? What does the killer clown have to do with the Splash Mountain? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just enjoy the fact of the motion of the cart and like the fact that there's images. Like, so I think that I was enjoying that a lot more. And then certainly when I was rereading it again last evening, then I was well prepared, and so at this point I was all on board and really enjoying the imagery of what's going on. And again, once you don't really pay attention or care who's coming on and off the stage other than, you know, Amelia kind of wandering around and being confused more than anything, I think it's a lot more enjoyable.
That's a great observation, because the whole gimmick of the story, if we were to take story B seriously, the gimmick of story B is that there's a character who's unfamiliar with this setting, who's been thrust into it, and so she's the reader surrogate, right? This is, you know, pretty standard trope. This is, you know, what the hobbits are in the Lord of the Rings and in The Hobbit, for that matter. This is why so many later variations of stories similar to the Lord of the Rings have, like, to have young characters, you know, adolescents from small towns or just like farms, so that they don't know anything about what's outside their village, and the world can get explained to them. Really can get explained to us, right? But that there's a sort of in-world, in-story reason for that. And that is what Gaiman is doing here, though I hadn't really thought about it in those terms. That she gives us just this, you know, it allows him to obfuscate for us what is happening and just to layer on all this mood.
And right before we depart this particular part of story B, I just love the image of, so there's this ooze where the servant had been, and Amelia decides she's going to dip her fingertip into the noxious stuff. She licked her finger and she made a face. You would appear to be right, sir, whoever you are, she said. I would estimate that he has been dead for the better part of 100 years. Just the idea that it's just like, oh, there's ooze where there was once a body. I'm going to A, stick my finger in it, B, taste it? And then see, from the taste of the ooze, I know 100 years is the proper amount of time that this person would have died. It's just like, there are many things that you should not do there. I think that this person would be happy to find themselves among the crew of the Nostromo or any number of other space opera kind of, or, you know, space horror vessels.
Yeah, so certainly we are living in a world now where even if you were not a germaphobe at the start of 2020, we are all germaphobes now. So this did strike me as totally disgusting. But yeah, also the logistics of how exactly do you develop an expertise in tasting goo to determine how long it's been dead? Like, what? How many times do you have to try this? How do you verify your results to know that you're on the right track? What precisely about the sort of flavor profile indicates to you that it's 100 years old and not one, you know, or 6 months? These are not details we are ever going to get. They are not details that matter. But wow, does it make me shiver and cringe?
Do you think that part of the reason why she thought that Lord Falconmere seemed like kind of a creep was because he either was too interested or not interested enough in her vast experience of tasting things? I don't know.
Yeah, I like to think that she was working in London as some kind of gothic CSI sort of tech. Actually, gosh, I would read that series of books. Someone needs to write that. I would totally read that. Well, let's carry on with the A story now. Back in the real world of the writer, there is a pretty young maid who has arrived at the house under mysterious circumstances only a few weeks ago. Right now, in this scene, she's building a fire. When she's done, the writer stares into the fire because, you know, that's how you brood. And then someone else is there. It's his older brother, long thought dead. But how? It doesn't matter. But maybe he really was dead. But it doesn't matter. Because in either case, no one would want to travel the paths that he has traveled. And anyway, more importantly, he's back to claim what is rightfully his. And at this, the writer just matter-of-factly says that, yeah, well, obviously, you're the older brother, so all of this belongs to you, and if you can prove who you really are, but just give it back to you. So the writer here is just really not rising to the occasion of the plot that he finds himself in. But his brother is great because he doesn't care. He's going to elevate the situation further. He's not going to bother with lawyers. He claims the right of blood, and he takes down the two swords that hang above the fireplace, and now there's this big duel. And in the end, the younger brother, our writer, mortally wounds the older brother. And then as the older brother dies, he gives a little speech where he just says, well, you know, he didn't really want the house, didn't really want the title. What he wanted was peace. And now, with his death, the family curse should finally be ended. Though there is still the matter of the thing in the abyss, the cellars, the rats. It follows, and that is his last words. Those are his dying words, a jumble of phrases with nothing to connect them. And when this business then is over, the writer admits that, of course, this sort of thing happens all the time, but whenever he tries to put something realistic, like this scene, in one of his stories, he ends up making a mockery of it. And I guess, right, that is the tone of the story B, the bold font story that we've been reading, this mockery. But this is where really I think we get explicit on the page that the storyteller is not really in our world. He's actually in a sort of metafictional gothic world of his own. And maybe I was being a little bit obtuse, but this is the point at least where I had figured that out. And this really opened up the whole story to me, where I finally understood kind of the mockery and the jokes and the tone of story B.
There's a lot of humor as his brother appears and they engage in a sword fight. And even the description of the sword fight is at times describing as if it's like a dance, a dainty, you know, a dainty minuet or a courtly and deliberate ritual, while at other times it seemed pure savagery. So, and they're going up and down the mezzanine and they're swinging from drapes and chandeliers and... yeah, we had the backdrop then of, you know, starting the whole scene with the chambermaid, and she has some mysterious past, and she wants to know, will that be all? And he says, yes, no, yes, you may go, Ethel. And it's like, you're wondering at that point, like, is he going to make a pass at her, or is he know of her secret, or, you know, what? Or does he just want to brood and complain, and it doesn't matter. And so here you have a lot more... there are characters going in and out of frame, and largely you're caring about the writer, but there seems to be more kind of backstory perhaps given to the other characters in story A than in story B, where really it just is Amelia, and then anyone else who appears won't be there very long. But it's all very much over the top, but also gives you a little bit more sense, I think, that there is a little bit wider world outside of view of the writer. Both stories are written from the third person perspective. So an omniscient narrator, however, the narrator, you know, has more to see in the real world than just the stuff that the, in story B the writer has to say about what's going on around Amelia. So then moving forward back to story B, outside the room, the ghoul lords howled with frustration and hunger. So we've moved ahead, and Amelia is now confronting ghoul lords in some cases, and is trying to remember what a woodcutter told her. The woodcutter, I like this description in which his words came back to her then in her time of need, as if he were standing close to her, his manly frame mere inches from her feminine curves, the very scent of his honest, laboring body surrounding her like the headiest perfume, and she heard his words as if he were that moment whispering them in her ear.
Yeah, that's priceless. Scent of his honest, laboring body. I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because of just kind of the over-top, like, you know, melodrama of, you know, a romance story here. But it's also funny because the kind of commentary of, like, that is the way that the character in story A would think to describe, you know, an attractive, sweaty member of, like, you know, the peasant class who is busy laboring away, right, outside of his mansion. It's just like...
Right, though clearly not actually a member of the peasant class, right? He says that he was not always a woodcutter, but he doesn't give her the details of that. But he used to have a different destiny. So, you know, he's obviously himself a fallen aristocrat of some kind, which is another stock trope of Gothic literature.
But she reminds he reminds her of the secret compartment that is in the old writing desk, and so she eventually finds a button in it, and there finds the compact. And the compact apparently is this long deal that her family has going back generations with whatever is residing under the stairs and in the crypts, and apparently the ghouls are owed brides. And that will satisfy their needs. At least maybe that's just what's necessary on tonight of all nights.
Right. Yeah, this is great here. And this is the Forbidden Brides, I guess, of the title, the Forbidden Brides of the Faceless Slaves. I guess we're in the secret house, and I guess this night of all nights is the night of dread desire. You know, whatever any of that actually really means. But here's the deal. Amelia says that she'll do it. She'll get the brides for them. I mean, I don't know what the logistics of that are, but basically, I mean, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with the brides, but it is certainly either one of two things, or I guess maybe it could be both. So it's one of three things, but it is going to be a non-consensual relationship of some sort, or they're going to be eaten, or it might be both. But Amelia is fine. She's going to do this because, you know, this is the bargain that her ancestors struck with whatever this is that lives in the crypt, the denizens of the crypt, maybe we'll call them. There is a joke at the end here. It's a joke that does not work for me at all. It takes me really right out of the story. And this is one of the ghouls asks if she'll throw in an order of bread rolls. This is a type of humor that Gaiman uses sometimes. Joss Whedon uses it a lot. Also, J. Michael Straczynski. I just do not enjoy this type of joke, but I wonder if it worked better for you.
No, oftentimes I like this joke far more than you do, I think, Glenn, in Buffy and sometimes Angel and, you know, Joss Whedon type verse, and even when Neil does it sometimes. But yeah, it didn't work for me in this story. It was a bridge too far, because I don't believe that in the high Gothic pastiche, quote-unquote real world that the narrator in story A or the character in story A lives in, and he's trying to capture that, you know, the honesty of that in story B, that, you know, the idea of little bread rolls doesn't seem, I mean, on the one hand, I guess it's trying to say that these things are commonplace, but it doesn't work for me. I think some other joke, A, it's not necessary. You could probably just cut it. But B, there's probably another way to have thrown the, like, this is normal kind of thing other than little bread roll things. Because that feels like it's a wink to us as the audience, not to him and his fellow people. And he does say that he throws in jokes that aren't very funny. So maybe it should just be something that's more pertinent to him or something like.
Yeah, that's a great point, because what it's doing is taking us out of the world of both the A story and the B story, right? That I don't believe that you can get takeaway bread rolls in the world of the A story, right? That's our world. So that is why it sucked me totally out of the world of the story, why I didn't think it functioned very well.
Yeah, it might have worked better if he was just like, and throw in left-handed newts, like, for instance, like, because that is ridiculous. but maybe that's ridiculous in a way that better fits what we believe the universe really is as this character perceives it.
Yes, right. An in-universe joke would have worked a lot better for me. I will say, for the record, I don't always hate this type of joke in Buffy and Angel. I don't always love the way Xander delivers those jokes, but the character Andrew, who appears late in Buffy, when he delivers these jokes, I always love it.
Yeah, it can really break the tone in the setting. So, and humor oftentimes is the way that we kind of escape or try to process stuff in our actual real life. And so also it works in stories sometimes. But here it's just, it immediately makes me think about going to a restaurant or being at a wedding or something where there's little, you know, rolls in a basket. And it just, it doesn't fit what I'm thinking of the Gothic pastiche. Again, I think something else would have worked there, which would have equally been maybe a not good joke, but would have been keeping in the theme of the story.
Well, let's do section 7 now. We're back in the A story. The writer is at his desk. He's struggling to write. The novel that he's writing, and which we have been reading as story B, is insufferable. He throws down his pen. He starts to curse the whole thing. I mean, like literally curse it. When the raven, who has been sitting on a bust of the writer's great, great, great grandfather, strikes up a conversation. Nothing unusual about this at all. Ravens often speak to people in this world. And what this one wants to know is if the writer actually enjoys writing realism, because he doesn't ever seem to be having fun while he's doing it. So maybe he should take up writing fantasy instead. And to this, the writer gives an impassioned defense of his project. He explains that what writers are for is to show people the world they live in, that what he is writing is literature, and fantasy is not literature. All fantasy is esoteric dreams written by a minority for a minority. Then the raven to this just says, nevermore. And then the writer thinks about it, decides to throw this current novel in the garbage, and he begins to think about a story that he could tell with some of the common tropes of fantasy literature. These are tropes we're all familiar with from fantasy literature, right? Things like cars and stockbrokers and commuters, housewives and police and income tax and cheap restaurants. And so that, right, finally, that is the gag, right? Our boring, mundane world, the world that we live in, though it's been less boring and mundane of late, I guess, but our boring, mundane world is the stuff of fantasy in the writer's world. And this speech here, or maybe not the speech, but this, I don't know, this scene here, this seems very much to be the voice of Gaiman. He's kind of, I don't know if mocking is right, but maybe trying to take to task people who think that fantasy is somehow not literature, or that speculative fiction is a lesser form of literature than realism. And I don't know that that's something that we really have to do anymore, but there was definitely a time, right, when speculative fiction writers were regarded as not real writers. And a lot of speculative fiction writers, you internalized that, right? This wounded a lot of them. This is something Gene Wolfe wrote about a lot, especially in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, well, and I think this still is not for listeners of this podcast necessarily, and or any part of Clay Temple Media probably don't have this misconception. But I do think there still is a general enduring sense that fantasy and science fiction and speculative fiction are not true art. And when they are, when the things that are able to cross over and are considered that, then, you know, if you go to, you know, what bookstores still exist, you know, particularly even big chains, I remember being frustrated that the writings of Kurt Vonnegut would be in literature or fiction. But if I want to see, you know, the writings of Neil Gaiman, oftentimes, sometimes now I think you might find them in fiction, but before they would always only be in science fiction fantasy. The fact that science fiction fantasy has its own category, as if that is, and you looked at, you know, how the things were marketed in that section and the covers, and it very much was directed at, no, this is juvenile literature. And, you know, if you have, you know, degrees and have studied things, then you're reading, you know, literature. And so it's just, you know, fairly drab looking covers of things. But that's where you'd find your Kurt Vonnegut, or even your Handmaid's Tale would be in the fiction section, but not in the, you know, speculative fiction section. I think that that's a kind of a problem in the way that kind of the snobbery that still, I think, does, you know, pervade segments of the literary world and the way society views these texts.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I had kind of even forgotten the dust up with Ian McEwan sort of proclaiming that he was going to write a science fiction novel that wasn't about, you know, the things science fiction novels are normally about, like spaceships and laser gun fights and or laser sword fights or whatever, and so on, in which it became totally clear that he had never actually read a science fiction novel and didn't know that they were mostly about the things he was saying he was going to do to revolutionize the field people had literally been doing for over 100 years. So I guess, you know, there is still that out there. I was thinking sort of the other way around. In fact, maybe to, I don't know, someone I kind of think of as in the same breath as Ian McEwan is Kazuo Ishiguro, who has gone on to write some science fiction stories. And he's a, you know, Nobel writer, and thinking about magical realism has gotten the Nobel recognition as well. And also thinking about the extent to which Tolkien has been and Lewis have been welcomed into the academy, right? You can take college level classes on these writers now. So, and because this is really the thing that Gene Wolfe would complain about, is that his writing was never going to be taken seriously by academics, which of course now is not true, right? There are people who have written their PhD dissertations on Gene Wolfe. People are teaching college classes on Gene Wolfe now. But that is, I think, you know, a massive improvement, a massive change from where we were when Gaiman wrote this. But there is still quite a bit of this. I guess what I was really thinking of, though, is the thing that has happened that I think felt more real for us in our youth when we would have been first reading Neil Gaiman in our adolescence, was that reading, being into speculative fiction is no longer just for nerds and geeks and dweebs, right? That the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Star Wars are huge, massive pop culture things, that they are not esoteric stories by a minority for a minority, which I think is what we felt in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I think some of the, there's a certain strange prestige which attaches itself to major film blockbusters like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, though, because I think that there are still people who are acquaintances of mine who, if I, you know, if I talk about going to see a Marvel film, they might be excited and want to join. But if I talk about reading a Marvel comic book, they'll assume that I'm still kind of pursuing a childhood kind of pursuit. And it's like, it's literally the same story. Yeah. Except for the budget is far more infinite in special effects in the printed, you know, comic. So, but I think things are better than they've been. But I think that still there's I think there will always be, to some extent, unfortunately, kind of cultural snobbery in which we define, you know, what is the other? We define what is the in-group that we want to be part of or that we already are part of. And in order to define what that group is, we need to identify or others to exclude, which is kind of unfortunate. And I mean, it plays out in politics and other ways, too. But yeah, I think that Neil very much here is kind of, you know, having fun with the and in kind of inverting kind of the trope and the kind of malignant thought about what is real literature versus what is not. And then, you know, even trying to make a little bit of an argument, although I don't know that we're supposed to take this as too serious of an argument given who's giving it. But the Scrivener thinks it is escapism, true, but it is not. But is it not the highest impulse in mankind, the urge toward freedom, the drive to escape? And I think there's something to be said for kind of escapism as having a value unto itself. But I think there's also something that that particular character doesn't understand, which is like, you know, science fiction and fantasy are often used to explore concepts where the setting and maybe the plot might have some escapist elements, but some of the actual ideas that are being tackled are just as much, if not more, realistic and human than you're going to encounter by reading about, you know, someone just, you know, dealing with something in a mundane sense.
Well, this is the common charge that is leveled at speculative fiction, is that it's escapist. And the underlying assumption there then, right, is that what books are for is to be didactic, that if a book is not teaching you something, something specific, something concrete, something tangible, something useful, then what's the point of reading it, this is definitely an attitude that I've encountered. I think we've all encountered people holding. And I've encountered this attitude, I mean, from people I really respect who are very good teachers, very good scholars, who will say things like, well, what's even the point of reading fiction, right? If you're going to read a book, shouldn't you be reading something that is real, something that is actually useful? But then, you know, these are people who are diehard sports fans. So they know what amusement is. They know what, you know, appreciating the beauty of some kind of art form is, but don't seem to think that, but somehow seem to hold books in some other type of category, where if you're going to spend time with books, right, that it should only be for didactic purposes and not simply to derive pleasure from it, right? Deriving pleasure is something that books are not for. Other things are for deriving pleasure, but not books, which is, that's a sad world. That's a sad worldview. I don't want to live in that. And I don't. And I'm glad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's also, it's a worldview that refutes the importance sometimes of allegory to even teach like moral lessons. And it's weird sometimes given, you know, people's belief structure sometimes hinging a lot on texts that rely in part or in whole on kind of the utility of allegory. It's strange to kind of put those things next to each other.
Yeah, and we don't need to pause here, although I'm tempted to, and like make the case for fiction, make the case for fantasy fiction. But I will say one more thing, just thinking with my teacher hat on, is that there's all sorts of research now about what reading fiction does for us, but especially what it does for kids, and has profound long-term effects. And the biggest thing, at least in my mind, is that it teaches empathy, besides, you know, improving things like vocabulary and comprehension for other types of reading. And, you know, even if you're just thinking in a utilitarian sense, improving, you know, SAT scores and GRE scores and LSAT scores, and so on, for, you know, getting a job in this world. But that it's actually how we learn to be human. It's a huge component of how we learn to be human, which is, you know, why we need to always be reading to kids or giving kids books and so on. But I just said I wasn't going to say all this and then did.
And
but
then
that,
you
was did. A, that was a small percentage of what I wanted to say.
But moving ahead.
Yeah.
So he's finally decided he's going to go for escapism, and he's going to tell a story that is fiction and involves those tropes that you identified before. So we cut back to story B, and story B has changed quite a bit. We still have Amelia Earnshaw, but she's no longer trying to worry about how she's mechanically going to get a number of brides and dinner rolls to the ghoul lords living in her crypt basement of her family's ancestral house. Instead, she's slicing some bread and putting it in the toaster and reflecting on her relationship with her husband, George, who is sitting there next to her in the kitchen reading the newspaper.
Right. This is, you know, just a sort of quotidian existence. It's the start of the day for a middle-class suburban family somewhere in the middle of the 20th century. You know, she's just cooking breakfast for her husband, which she does every day. George is just there reading the newspaper, and when Amelia asks how he'd like his eggs, he says he doesn't care, that he'll eat whatever she makes. She just stands there and cries because nothing matters. And right, this is Gaiman putting the mockery now on literary fiction. He's turning the tables on it. And I think he does a great job of it. This is a really awesome pastiche. There are some really funny bits here. Like, this thing opens with this kind of inner monologue from Amelia. It's an inner monologue about white bread, about how much she loves white bread, even though it has no nutritional value, but she hasn't eaten white bread in a decade because, you know, it's bad for you and one of the jobs you have as a housewife. And whenever this is supposed to be, the 1950s, or it might even be the 1980s, I suppose, you know, is to keep your figure, is to look good for your husband. And so you can't have the empty calories of white bread. And, you know, this thing just opens with just an inner monologue about white bread. This is what Gaiman thinks literary fiction is. It's monologues about white bread.
It is. And also wives who may despise their husbands, because she thinks to herself, and here we do have italics to give us, and which it's bolded italics because it's in story B, so it's bolded. But we have the italics for her inner thoughts, which whenever I think about italics and inner thoughts, I'm immediately brought back to Dune, because
yes.
I think half those books are the inner thoughts of characters, the way Frank Herbert gave it to us. But in which she's thinking about her husband and thinks, I hate him. I hate him. It was like a song. I hate him for his toast and for his bald head and for the way he chases the office crumpet, which is a weird anachronistic phrase that I think intentionally was used there by Neil. But girls barely out of school who laugh at him behind his back, and for the way he ignores me whenever he doesn't want to be bothered with me, and for the way he says, "What, love?" when I ask him a simple question as if he's long ago forgotten my name, as if he's forgotten that I even have a name. And then she immediately asks if he wants his egg scrambled or boiled, then he responds, "What, love?" There's a couple of things I kind of want to pull apart. Well, let's talk about the whole setting, the whole passage, and then we can pull apart kind of the relationship between the Amelia Earnshaw environment here versus before. So she's still thinking about her environment, and it then cuts to explain the narrator that that her husband, George, regards his wife with fond affection and would have been very surprised to learn of her hatred of him. So it's kind of them not understanding each other and not really listening. And, you know, he tells her, you know, when she asks again to the scrambled or boiled eggs, he says, "Anyway, you like it, love." And he thinks he's probably being helpful. He says it amiably. And the passage ends by saying, "Could not for the life of him, as he told everyone in the office later that morning, understand why she simply stood there holding her slice of toast or why she started to cry." So here we have a husband and wife completely disconnected from each other. She hates him because of his inability to kind of understand her. He doesn't understand her, but and talks about that with the people in the office. And it's kind of a, you know, sad little bit of prose about these people's lives. And in some ways, it's far, far more tragic than dealing with all of the death and ghouls and terribleness that we were having just on the edges and also in the forefront, I guess, of what Amelia was experiencing in the nonfiction world, as it were, previously.
Right. I assume that George here is labeled as George Earnshaw, but I was just envisioning if there were a visual adaptation of this, and I don't know, maybe there actually is a comic adaptation of this. That seems to be happening to so many of his short stories now, but you know, or a film, that these would be the same characters that we saw in the original B story that we were getting, and that this would be the woodcutter with the scent of his laboring body or whatever, and you know, now they're transported to this different environment where instead of being really awesome, really interesting, larger than life protagonists in a fantastical world, they're just mundane people in a mundane world. They're banal people in a banal world with banal problems that just make us as readers also depressed. Though I will say that, much like I wish that there had been an entire 200-page novel of the B story, the story B that we started with, I would read this book too. I whatever this is going to turn into, I think this is gorgeously written. I'm actually compelled by these characters. I would like to see what's happening with their crumbling marriage. I'm curious about, you know, if we assume that this is the opening of the book or somewhere in the middle of chapter one anyway, what's going to be the incident that's going to, you know, tear this world up in some way and force them to reckon with their marriage. I'm hooked. I'll read this.
Well, and I hadn't thought of George being, you know, if this was a play, being depicted by the same person who is the woodcutter. I always kind of pictured that George maybe was more akin to the ghoul lord, and it's the brides that the ghouls, you know, were promised is in part what Amelia now is in this scenario, where it's just kind of a tragic fate for her, where she's in a marriage that appears, at least from her perspective in this particular passage, to lack what she wants, and that maybe the woodcutter is either how she remembers George being when they met, or maybe the person who she thinks about when she wants to escape from thinking about George.
Actually, I hadn't really thought about the way that the title of the story might apply to this version of story B, but Faceless Slaves is something that jumps out to me, right? That she is kind of, you know, a faceless servant to George Earnshaw. And in fact, we should read this passage. That's pretty great. George Earnshaw regarded his wife with fond affection and would have found her hatred of him astonishing. He thought of her in the same way and with the same emotions that he thought of anything which had been in the house for 10 years and still worked well. The television, for example, or the lawnmower. He thought it was love, right? So she's, you know, this and this whole business with where he calls her love because he like doesn't even remember that she has a name. That's faceless, right? And she's there to serve him the same way that the TV and the lawnmower are.
Well, in the same way that if there's a compact between some, you know, mortal family and ancestral ghouls living in the crypt, they need brides, but just temporarily and for, you know, a period of time before the brides are, I don't know, eaten or die naturally, who knows, but they're kind of, there maybe is not for their own kind of personhood and but just kind of utility of checking off the list and, you know, referring to the compact here as being maybe the compact being here, maybe the marriage vows or something like that, where it's just it's this piece of paper that's binding things in ways that maybe they would rather not still be bound.
Right. And I could see that being the incident, the inciting incident that gets the story going here, right? Her decision that she reaches on this day of all days while he's at work, that maybe she wants a divorce, right? And if this is the 50s or 60s or even the 80s, right, that would be a bit, you know, of a unconventional, a bit shocking, if not necessarily scandalous. And yeah, well, I would read that story.
And I think when I got to this passage, Section 8, I can't tell because there's so much being conveyed and there's a lot of detail and there's a lot of, you know, fairly good Neil Gaiman writing, which means really good writing by anyone else's standards, that kind of really kind of grabs you. But it feels like there's less detail per inch of text than there was previously in this section. So I felt like even though the story is about someone who kind of is dealing with a claustrophobic type environment, I almost felt like I could breathe more freely. And I don't know if it's because it's dealing with a scenario where I don't have to worry about like how the velvet curtains are, you know, shrugging in the forked tongue of the lightning, or if it's just that like there's less being packed into this because we're focusing more on minute details about two pieces of toast, one that does come out of the toaster and the other one that rips. And, you know, the detail of mentioning just very simple objects without a lot of descriptors. It's not the television and the lawnmower. We think, you know, it's presented to us, as you said, about things that work well, but there's not adjectives attached to either the description of the television and the lawnmower other than that. It's not the, you know, luxurious lawnmower or the, you know, useful lawnmower, the way that I feel that I'd be dealing a lot more with epithets and stuff in the prior text, like something out of Homer.
One of the things we can do in comparing the two different versions of Story B here are to look at what needs to be built, right? What's the world? What's the setting? What's the mood that needs to be constructed by the writer? So in the Gothic pastiche, it is the external world, right? It's where are the characters? What does that look like, right? What's the sensory input of that? And then also, what are all of the social relationships? And in the fantasy and in the pastiche of what for us would be literary fiction, none of that has to be built up because we know what a suburban home's kitchen looks like, right? We've experienced that, or we've at least seen it on TV enough times to be able to envision that. What is being built, the setting, the mood, and even the tone and world, all of that is internal to the characters, right? And so it's a totally different type of description. I would suggest that the passage here in this literary fiction pastiche to compare to some of the real purpleness of the Gothic fiction pastiche is this internal monologue about white bread, right? That strikes us as over the top and kind of ridiculous. That, you know, I do have internal monologues. Maybe most of us do, I guess. I do some musings from time to time, maybe especially in the morning if I haven't had any coffee yet. But it's definitely not quite this purpley, right? Even when I am in a bad mood, even when I am feeling ennui and wondering how my life has led to this moment and maybe isn't there a better life somewhere that I would rather be living, my internal monologues don't sound like this, right? So I think that's where Gaiman is doing the same thing, but just applying it to a different component of the story. It's the interiority versus the, or the interior world versus the exterior world. I do definitely wish that we had short novels, 150, 200-page novels of both of these story Bs here, and they could be printed together sort of in this way that books used to be, where you would print two books in one cover to save printing costs, and one half of the book, one story in the book would be oriented up, down, one way, and then you'd flip it over and have to like really, you know, turn it top to bottom in order to read the other book. That's a gimmick I would love to see Gaiman do with these stories. I mean, there are other books I might like to see him write before this, but I would love this. Maybe there's a copy of this in the library in The Dreaming somewhere.
I mean, there has to be, right?
yes, because I just imagined it. That's how it works.
You just dreamed of it, so it's there. We just need Lucien to find it for us. So then we cut back for the final time to story A, in which the writer is engrossed in what he is doing, and we're told his face was strangely content, and a smile flickered between his eyes and his lips. He was rapt. So, you know, finally he's content and is happy with what he is doing and is focused on it and not focused on all of the cacophonous kind of nightmare fodder, if it were ever present around him. but we cut away to elsewhere in the house, in which Tomes, the butler, is talking to Ethel, the chambermaid.
Right, but she's not really a chambermaid, right? She's the chambermaid who isn't really a chambermaid, and he's about to reveal some sort of secrets, and he's making her swear. This is classic stuff. This really felt sort of like Wilkie Collins's The Moonstone to me, though maybe that's just because much of that is narrated by the butler and does have to do with secrets, and I don't know. There is a chambermaid, I think, at the core of that. It's been actually a while since I've read that book, though I love that book. But yeah, this is a great way to end, right? Because he zooms back out, Gaiman zooms back out to the world of story A to show us that even though the writer is now having a blast writing this fantasy fiction that looks like literary fiction to us, the world around him, the real world that he lives in, is still this gothic world. I love the way that this story ends. I really love this story in general. But now that we're at the end, Brent, I want to ask, what did you think of this story? We did, you know, preface a little bit of this at the top of the show.
When I quickly read it, before we were talking about Into the Night, the Sandman issue where the title appears as part of Zelda's dream, I wasn't in the right mood for it. I think I kind of got the gist of it and enjoyed it well enough by the end, but I was kind of annoyed for the first few pages just because of how over the top it was, and it intentionally read to me like a better produced version of what you'd expect, like a teenager who's just kind of trying to throw in as many tropes as possible and, you know, add story upon story. It annoyed me, and it is a completely different tone from where you're at when you're reading Into the Night and where you're at in that volume of Sandman. But having reapproached it last evening, fully knowing what it was and not having it juxtaposed against something that is far more serious. I think I read it after watching What We Do in the Shadows. I was far more ready for just like, let me just embrace the chaos and the humor. And the humor in many cases is very thin, but it's supposed to be very thin. And so, you know, kind of, again, slapstick is what comes to mind. So if I imagine that the Marx Brothers are portraying most of these characters, then it fits. And so it really did work for me. I think it probably could have been a little shorter, which is a weird thing to say about a story that's fewer than 12 pages, I guess. I mean, honestly, probably could have been 8 and gotten the gist across.
Well, I absolutely loved this story. I do agree that it probably could have been shorter, probably could have been two sections shorter. We could have cut one section out of the out of story A and probably one out of story B, though I wouldn't want to pick which one of those to go, because I did like every scene in this story. And, you know, maybe in some ways I am kind of the target audience for this, even though this is a speculative fiction podcast network, that's what we do here. If someone were to really press me to sort of rank my favorite novels of all time, Jane Eyre would actually be near the top of my list. And in fact, maybe even The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins might be near the top of my list ahead of some of the things that we do here on the network. I love 19th century fiction. I love 19th century prose, and especially Gothic prose. I mean, this is one of the things we do over on Elder Sign. We do a lot of 19th century Gothic stuff over there. I always am raving about it. Well, almost always. There have been a couple stinkers, but for the most part, I'm always raving about it. So I think in some sense, I am kind of a target audience for this story to really get a kick out of this, both in terms of enjoying the prose, right, where he's mimicking that style, but then also the fact that he's playing with all of the tropes, all of the conventions of that genre. In fact, I'll say one thing that's maybe looking ahead a little bit, which because we have already recorded our episode that we're airing next, the episode on Only the End of the World Again, which we did because that was something that was commissioned by a Patreon supporter. So when that happens, we record the episodes right away and get them to the person who has commissioned it. And then we release it whenever it's a good time to do that on the main show, which is to say we don't interrupt our Sandman coverage to do that. So we're airing that next. But the Patreon supporter who did commission that episode has heard it already and has chimed in on our conversation there and said something that I heartily agreed with, or at least that resonated with me because it's my feeling as well, which is said that he enjoys the Gaiman stories. The stories by Gaiman that he enjoys the most are the stories where the main character is actually the genre that he's working in. And I think that that is true for me as well, that is where I also enjoy Neil Gaiman the most. And this is a story like that, right? The main character of this story is Gothic stories, right? It's the genre of Gothic literature is the main character in this story. And so that really works for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think both of us would recommend this story to almost anyone with the caveat of go in with the right mood, which is just that you want something that is at times fairly dense, but in terms of imagery, but also take it light, which I think it's weird to kind of go into a story initially thinking that in terms of I'm going to deal with a lot of dense imagery, but I should deal with it in a very kind of light and airy way. And particularly when it's Gothic horror, to be like, no, this Gothic horror, I need to be very light and airy as I approach it. but I think it works. And I think that combination of things is a lot of fun if you're in the mood for it. And so I think it's a hard thing. You don't want to give away anything to anyone, but you also, it's best if you're a little prepared for it. So it almost needs a little trigger warning on the top of it.
And this is a story that, although, you know, it's now been printed and sold, you and I have both enjoyed it. It was a trunk story for a long time. And that's what he writes about in the introduction to Fragile Things, is that he'd shown it to a handful of editors and they all panned it. I mean, they really told him it was a total garbage story. He does say that maybe there were some bits of it that were not particularly well written when he took it out of the trunk to revise it, to send it off to this collection called Gothic with an exclamation point at the end. The story definitely, I didn't look to see what that collection was, though maybe that's something we should get our hands on. That might be fun to do. But I could see this story being kind of the funny pastiche story in a collection that is filled with otherwise serious sort of engagements with or straight-faced maybe engagements with Gothic literature, that this would be the story that you put at the end or maybe in the middle to add some levity to the whole project.
Yeah, so he mentions that he shared this with a couple editors back in the day before he put it in the trunk, and he got kind of some mixed responses, but generally not very good. I also found a discussion of, as with many of Neil Gaiman's short stories, which we've talked about in a couple other instances, this short story was turned into, did have comic panels added to it to turn into a comic. I don't actually have it, but Dark Horse did put out a copy of Forbidden Brides of the Faceless Slaves, Faceless Slaves in the Secret House of the Night of Dread Desire, with art by Shane Oakley. And I found a review of that online from a site called pixelatedgeek.com back from 2017, in which I encourage people to take a look at the review if they're interested maybe at picking up that volume. It sounds like, based on the review, I'm probably going to go back and try to pick up that volume because it sounds like the art does a great job conveying a lot of the imagery associated with the story.
Was that sold as a standalone or was it packaged with other stories?
Nope, it was sold as a standalone, much as they've done with It's Only the End of the World again and some of the other things. So,
oh, fantastic. I mean, at some point, right, as we are sort of accruing short stories in our breaks between volumes of The Sandman and you know, eventually between novels or other comics that we're reading, I think it would be good to go look at the adaptations, do an episode where we look at the comic adaptations of prose stories like this that we've covered. I don't know, we could probably do, you know, two or three in a single episode. I think that would be a lot of fun. That'll be something that happens in, you know, 2024, I guess, something like that, when we've accrued several of them.
But anyways, in that article, at the very end, he includes a quote from Neil, in which Neil was doing a reading of the short story at some bookstore in Berkeley. It doesn't say particularly which one. But the quote, which kind of mirrors what is discussed in Fragile Things, but it's a little different, and it's kind of funny, so I'll share it here. It was, Neil said, "And it was printed, and it won a Locus Award for Best Story of the Year," which it did in 2005, as an aside, "which I suppose, if I'd been mean and cruel and vindictive, I would have actually hunted down one of the people who told me not to publish it and said, 'Just won a Locus Award.' But instead, I think I learned a very valuable lesson about listening to other people, which is, not worth the effort. Ha, no, different people like different things." So, which I think that both of those lessons sometimes are maybe good. occasionally, it is not worth the effort to listen to other people. Oftentimes, though, it is. And you should just take it as different people will like different things, which I think if anyone read this story and did not like it, I would say either different people like different things or different people like different things depending on when they read it. Maybe give it another shot if you thought you might like it at all.
Yeah, or, you know, flip the page, read the next story. I mean, this is always the case with short story selections. You're not going to love every single story. This is why Gene Wolfe always says you should not read them like a novel. Don't read them back to back. Read one, put the book down, come back a few months later, read another one, right? Don't treat each story, give each story its due. Don't try to rush through the thing like it's a novel, because you'll have trouble kind of switching those moods and those tones. Well, I think now that we have delved into some of the meta commentary that Gaiman has said about this story, and we're talking about general advice for reading short story collections, I think we've done this one. I think that's going to do it for this episode. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brent Helt. You can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. And please head on over to the Clay Temple forums or our subreddit and let us know what you thought of Forbidden Brides of the Faceless Slaves in the Secret House of the Night of Dread Desire, particularly on this day of all days.
I just cannot hear that title without just grinning and chuckling a little bit. Well, we're going to be back next week with an extra episode. As we said, this is one that was commissioned by one of our Patreon supporters, which is why it's an extra episode. And that is the story, Only the End of the World Again. You can find that in the collection Smoke and Mirrors. And if you would like to join us on Patreon so that you can get discounts on commissioning bonus episodes of your own, and also, and maybe especially, help us reach our new goal of doing a bonus series on At the Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft, please do check us out on patreon.com/claytemplemedia. But until next time, pleasant dreams.